Thank you very much, Arya Jaya, and thanks very much for asking me to come. I was really pleased to get Arya Jaya's email mentioning this series which you have going on tantric symbols, I think, or symbols associated with tantric Buddhism. And I was pleased because I actually had a date free when it would work, and it wasn't too far ahead. One of the things I don't like about Tri Ratna, that doesn't sound right, that didn't come out right, is this thing of booking up, you know, years in advance. I really, really don't like it. And I try to leave quite a lot of my diary open so that I can do something reasonably spontaneous or fairly spontaneous, like come to Cambridge and give a talk. And fortunately, that's been happening a bit as well with the LBC. So when I gave my talk at the LBC the other day, I just said to Knyonov Archer, I'm passing through, do you want me to give a talk? Yes, please. You know, and I much prefer that way of operating. And I was particularly pleased to be asked to be part of this series. And Arya Jaya very kindly let me talk about anything. She didn't suggest anything. And she said I could do anything, even. She said you could lead a meditation, you could lead a puja, you could do some chanting, you could give a talk. So I had sort of carte blanche. But I realised there was something I wanted to explore. I think explore is a much better word than give a talk on, actually. So I called it imagining the tantric gathering or imagining the tantric community, and then that other title popped up a bit later. In a way, certainly it isn't an invitation. It can't be an invitation to a tantric gathering because I don't have the authority to invite anybody to a tantric gathering. What interests me, I suppose, is, you know, we have all this wonderful imagery that emerges out of tantric Buddhism, from Indian tantric Buddhism, Tibetan tantric Buddhism, and of course Sino-Japanese tantric Buddhism. Wonderful imagery, but what interests me is the community it comes from the people it comes from. Of course, the tradition will say it all emerges out of the Dharmakaya, you know, through the Sambhogakaya and descends down through the line of the Siddhas. And I won't dispute that traditional way of describing things, but it's still associated with people. You know, Bhante Sangharakshita once famously said, there's no such thing as Buddhism. There are only Buddhists. There is no such thing as enlightenment. There is only an enlightened being, enlightened beings. And I think that is tremendously important, that when we, you know, when we approach the Dharma, when we approach looking at Buddhism, we always try to imagine or think about or reflect on the people from whom it comes, from who, you know, the communities from which it arises. I think there's another reason why I'm particularly interested in the tantric community, and I must admit, it is a bit risky doing a talk on imagining the tantric community, because it is actually a hard community to imagine. I'm thinking particularly of Indian tantric Buddhism, the origins of tantric Buddhism, rather than, you know, living tantric Tibetan communities. It's very difficult because the material is there isn't a lot of material available, really. There are some very pioneering, there's some pioneering work going on by various scholars who are sort of really looking at the texts, looking and drawing out little kind of visions of these communities. And I'm thinking particularly of a writer I'm very fond of, Ronald M. Davidson, whose book, Indian Esoteric Buddhism, A Social History of the Tantric Movement, is very dear to me. Really trying to, you know, to see what this community was actually like. And the thing that I'm particularly interested in, it's not just anthropology or, you know, an interesting bit of religious history. It's to do with the nature of spiritual community generally, Buddhist spiritual community, Sangha. My lines of thought, to give it, you know, to talk too much of, to overstate my thinking processes, but my lines of thought are usually in relationship to my own Buddhist practice and my interactions with the order and the Tree Ratna community generally. And the area that I've been particularly interested in my own studies and reading, not just in Indian tantric communities, but also more widely in religious communities, is, if you like, you could call it the tension, if you like, between the intimacies which are absolutely crucial within a spiritual community. I don't mean sexual intimacies, I mean spiritual intimacies, which are absolutely necessary for a flourishing spiritual community, and its relationship with a public. A public and its public expression. A public expression or a public relationship which will often distort the nature of what you're trying to do within a spiritual community. It might be that outside of the spiritual community you've got very worthy, good things going on, which, you know, which are okay, but they're not what the Buddhist life, the spiritual life, is really all about. And you can see these sort of pressures coming on vital spiritual communities from a public, from even a civic society, which actually starts to undermine the vitality of the spiritual community. And I guess the tantric community is particularly, or the glimpses of the tantric community are particularly interesting for me, because in tantric Buddhism, you get this word used frequently, guhya, which is usually translated as secret or esoteric. History of the Indian esoteric Buddhism, the rise of the tantric movement. So esoteric is a translation of the word guhya. Because the rise of Indian tantric Buddhism is very much characterized as being secret, as being guhya. One of the great founding myths of tantric Buddhism is the subjugation by Vajrapani of Shiva, Rudra, and the Hindu gods. Vajrapani is called Guhyapati, the Lord of the Secrets, the Lord of the Secrets, the Lord of the Secret Mantra Path. And Vajrapani, you know, who starts life in Buddhist history as a humble yaksha, is through his spiritual practice, becomes a great bodhisattva, eventually becomes an emanation of Vairochana, who really does a job on the Hindu gods and forces them to convert to Buddhism and go for refuge. And indeed, Shiva is predicted to Buddhahood by Vairochana as, and he will be known as the Lord of Ashes, presiding over a pure land called the Realm of Ashes. There's a sort of in joke there to do with Shaiva ascetics and ash, covering themselves in ashes. But it's this business of the secret. It can sound like secret societies, esoteric communities, and all that sort of thing. Bhante Sangharakshita, my teacher, our teacher, he has a different view of this word guhya, a very interesting view of it, very interesting interpretation, which I have thought about quite a lot. He talked about this when, in an early lecture on going for refuge, where he talked about the real nature of what he calls effective going for refuge. When you're going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha really starts to happen. And we associate this very much with the Dharmachari ordination, with our ordination ceremony. And what was interesting about that, he didn't sort of define effective. I've gone through the talk quite carefully. He just talks about the refuges in their guhya nature. And the word guhya, he points out, means of the cave of the heart. It's secret in that sense. because he said it's very, very difficult to talk about what is going on in the cave of the heart. Very difficult to talk, to communicate experience, direct experience, intimate experience. Just in ordinary life, it's very difficult to talk about experience, to say what is really going on. He said in spiritual life, in Dharma life, it's even more difficult. It's even more difficult to give proper, true expression to what is really happening in the intimacies of your heart and the interplay between you and your close spiritual friends. That is why Tantric Buddhism is secret. Because you're talking about intimate experience. And he went on to say that the Guhya refuges in Tantric Buddhism are the Guru, the chosen deity, and the Dakini, pointing out that in Tantric Buddhism, there's a tremendous concern with experience. So who is the Buddha in your experience? You can't know the Buddha of 2,500 years ago. You're nowhere near the Sambhogakaya, you know, the archetypal Buddha or the Dharmakaya. So who's the Guru in your experience? It's going to be your teacher. He's the person who's more developed than you. So that is the Buddha in your experience. It's not making really a claim about your teacher. It's saying in your experience, this is the person who demonstrates a higher level of consciousness than you occupy yourself. As for the chosen deity, the Ishta Devata, as it's called in Sanskrit, the greatly desired deity, the Yidam, in Tibetan Buddhism, the oath-bound. This is the meditation practice, particularly the course of what they call sadhana, the effective meditation practice that the guru gives you at the time of initiation. This will be, you know, maybe one of the great bodhisattvas, but in Tantric Buddhism it would have been something a bit more fearsome and strange, probably. But again, the argument is that, look, you're not going to know all the 84,000 Dharma Skandhikas. You're not going to know all the 84,000 heaps of the Dharma. You don't have a direct experience of reality face to face. What you need is that, if you like, that image, that person, that being that communicates the Dharma directly to you, which is given to you by your teacher directly. That is your experience of the Dharma refuge. As for the Sangha, it's the Dakini. This is the secret, esoteric refuge version of the Sangha. And by Dakini, Sangharakshita thought it wasn't simply one of these beautiful, dancing, naked goddesses. He sees the Dakini much more as the force of tremendous inspiration, dharmic inspiration, that is sparked off when you have really deep, close, authentic communication with others in your shared spiritual community, usually following the same teacher and following the same practices that have been transmitted. That's the Dakini. It's this quality of delight, ecstasy, authenticity that is sparked off in very close, intimate communication. It's very interesting that Sangharakshita chose to talk about effective going for refuge in this way. It's interesting because I don't think you can really claim that Tri Ratna is a tantric community, is a tantric movement. I don't think we can really do that, certainly not sort of technically, I would say, or officially, so to speak. But I think he's trying to get at the spirit of what has to happen in a serious spiritual life. When you make that commitment to really pursuing, really following the path of the Dharma, when you really go for refuge, when you're going for refuge, it has effects. The refuges come alive. The refuges come near to you. You see them more directly. They move from being they're not just profound, sublime ideals. It's very important that we hold that reverence for these sublime ideals. They're coming into your concrete experience. They're activated through your engagement with the community you've chosen to be a part of. Whether or not you're an official tantric practitioner, all Buddhists need to make the refuges alive in their direct experience. So this is... I'm interested in this. Well, more than interested, as you could imagine. I'm inspired by it. I'm moved by it. And as I say, I think that there is a very real tension between what you're really doing as a spiritual practitioner, a Dharma practitioner, with close spiritual friends, and engagement with the world around, where there are so many pressures, so many kind of worldly ideas, even very worthy worldly ideas, which can dilute, which can undermine, you know, what you're really trying to do together as you practice intensively together. So I wanted to have a go at trying to imagine the tantric community. And it's difficult because you only really get glimpses. Perhaps the first thing to say about the tantric community is that it transcends any kind of ecclesiastical designation. So among the siddhas, who are the great tantric adepts, there's lists of 84 or more or less. You'll find monks. You'll find, I think you might even find some nuns as well. But you'll certainly find full-time religieuses, so to speak. You know, pretty proper Buddhist monks. You'll also find what you might call laymen, householders, kings, ministers, thieves, prostitutes, merchants, musicians, old people, young people, fat people, thin people, ugly people. One of the wonderful things about the lives of the siddhas is the fact that they're people drawn from all walks of life. And typically the stories of the interaction of these people with the tantric adept, the siddha, is always to do with them engaging with the particular concern or issue, even the particular klesha, the poison, that the person is caught up with. So let's try and think of an example of that. Well, there's the story of the king, who is very, very wealthy, very, very powerful, who loved jewels. And one day, I think he's an anonymous siddha, I don't think he's got a name. This siddha, and you can imagine these rather disreputable, the tantric people tended to be rather disreputable, looking, you know, with long hair and scantily dressed and bone ornaments and, you know, sort of, you know, beards and, you know, all the rest of it. And, you know, really people you'd rather not invite for dinner. This guy just wanders in and he just challenges the king. You know, he just starts to bawl out. Well, who's greater, you or me? I'm greater than you. I'm greater than you. And there's a real... You know, king's furious, you know, and, you know, has him hauled up before him. But he's impressed by this man. This man talks to him in a riddling, direct way. And the king says, look, I can't do what you do. I can't enjoy that great bliss that you say that you have access to and that freedom, because I'm too attached, especially to my jewels. I love my jewels. Look at this ring on my finger. I love this ring. So the tantric said, have a look in the ring. Have a look in there. Have a good look. Really concentrate. And of course, the king can concentrate because he loves this jewel so much. There's so much desire, so much love of gems. It's very, very easy for him to concentrate all his attention on this jewel. And then the siddha says, see, look in there. Can you see? Can you see the Buddha form in the centre? Some strange tantric deity. Can you see the other figures around it? And the king says, oh, yes, I can. And very, very quickly, he becomes an accomplished one. He becomes a siddha. So there's this wonderful sort of sense of what the tantric community is doing, is engaging with people where they are. exactly where they are, and bringing that into the Dharma life, not seeing it as a problem or as an issue, but channeling it, if you like, into the Dharma. There's the lovely story of Vinapa. Vinapa played the Vina, that's why he was called Vinapa. And he loved his music, you know, playing his Vina, getting ecstatic, playing his Vina, bumps into a Siddha. And the Siddha communicates very strongly with him. Vinapa's very impressed by the Siddha's communication, the Siddha's conversation, the Siddha's presence. And he says, look, I'd love to follow you, but I can't because I'm so addicted to music. I love music. And of course, music in Buddhist tradition, Buddhist monks, a bit dodgy, you know, shouldn't enjoy music. You might get sort of distracted by the pleasures of the senses, perhaps that's in the background. And the Siddha says, no, play your Vina, but listen for the unstruck sound. The unstruck sound, not the sound that is struck, but the unstruck sound. So Vinapa goes for it, trying to find the unstruck sound. And he finds it, and lo and behold, it becomes the Siddha himself. I was at an amazing concert last night, by the way, in London, talking of unstruck sounds. If you ever get a chance, go and see this Australian trio called The Necks. Piano, double bass and drums. There's so much unstruck sound in their free improvs. Fantastic. I mean, you feel as though you're away with the spirits listening to these guys. But anyway, I'm getting off topic, perhaps, or perhaps not. So you have this. You have this sense of people engaging with people where they are. Some Sangharakshitas once said, in some ways, the tantric community is a bit of a return to early Buddhism. That seems quite a strange thing to say, given the weird and wonderful practices that tantrics get up to. But he points out that probably by the time the tantric movement arose, Buddhism has become very, very institutionalised. You've got the rise of great monasteries, which of course are wonderful centres of culture and practice. In many ways, the Siddha tradition is a return to the streets, a return to the forests, a return to the people, taking the Dharma to people where they are, and not bothering about any kind of ecclesiastical designation. What's important is to wake up to the way things are. What's important is to attain Siddhi, the supreme Siddhi. What's important is the complete dissolution of self and other, and the opening up into the supreme great bliss, the Mahasukha, which completely transcends self and other, the great ecstasy, which is also the great love and the great compassion, because the love just pours out of the great bliss. That's what the tantrics are particularly concerned with. And it seems that a lot of the practice and a lot of the teaching and a lot of the initiation, because initiation is very, very important in these traditions, happened in secret. It happened on mountaintops, in caves, happened, of course, in cremation grounds. I've had a talk on the great cremation grounds. The great cremation grounds regarded as very, very important places of initiation. And, of course, you have to remember that cremation grounds are untouchable. They're outcast. This is away from caste Hindu society and all those designations. The dead are regarded as impure and unclean. The people who stay in the place of the dead are regarded as unclean. It's a place, if you like, of sort of penance and purification, but a place of where tremendous spiritual experience can happen, and even initiation can happen. And we're talking about lonely Indian cremation grounds, way outside the villages. This is where initiation can happen. This is where the community can gather. It might also be a grove of trees, a kind of pleasure grove in some wealthy layman's grounds. But some very interesting descriptions of what would be set up: a big canopy, cushions set out with wonderfully patterned lotus coverings over pillows, and guards, guardians. And you can't get in unless you show the right mudras, the right gestures, and otherwise you can't come into this gathering. You can't be part of this meeting. Again, I think this is this sort of thing, of course, sounds very intriguing and exciting. What on earth do they get up to? We all want to be there. But I tend to think, again, I think it's very important to remember that it's very, very difficult to talk. It should be difficult to talk about the intimacies of spiritual experience, dharmic experience and communication. One of the things I find particularly sort of vulgar in, and I'm a fine one to talk about vulgarity, but anyway, I find it particularly vulgar, is people sort of wanting to know what attainment you have, or what insight you have, or what insight somebody else has. You can apparently do it all on the internet these days, you know, kind of what level you are. I mean, really? I mean, is it possible to really articulate your finer, deeper, purer experiences in that way? I mean, for me, if I do start to go nearer to deeper experience, the language becomes more poetic. It becomes more elusive. It ceases to be, it becomes much less conceptual, for a start. And there needs to be a particular environment, a particular atmosphere for that communication to actually take place, to happen. Sometimes I don't even know what my experience is. That's a strange one, isn't it? What my deeper, finer experiences are, until I am in a particular communication with someone. You know, somebody or a group of people might draw something out in me that I wasn't aware that I knew, that I wasn't aware, some treasure that I didn't even know that I had. I think spiritual community is really about that, creating the atmosphere, the environment, where there is that possibility of much deeper communication, more intimate communication. So in a way, you could say it's not just the tantric community that is secret and esoteric and hidden away. It's every spiritual community. Every sangha, it should be, if it's a real sangha, should really be like that. The name of the, you get different names for the tantric spiritual community. You get the word kula, which means, kula could be translated as family. In one of Sangharakshita's talks, he characterises, this is his talk on the Vajra, from his own exploration of the tantric symbols. He said, the Vajra Kula, Vajra meaning is, of course, the symbol for reality, naked reality. The Vajra Kula is the spiritual community where everybody is naked. Everybody is naked. Not necessarily literally, but everybody is naked. Everybody is completely true and authentic with one another. Of course, it doesn't, because when we use language like that, we think it's going to be some sort of heavy encounter group, if you remember those things. Of course, being really naked with one another might be extraordinarily gentle, extraordinarily refined, as well as very, on occasion, very direct and very, very clear. I remember in India, I lived in India for many years. One of my most formative experiences, I think, working with our order members in India, learning from our Indian order members. And in India, I don't think Indian order members would describe themselves as tantric, but I did meet some old boys, some old men, old dharmacharis, older than me in years, who really had this kind of almost siddha quality about them. They'd had their family had grown up, everybody was settled, and they'd just wander and communicate the Dharma. And one in particular was called Sangha Sen, the army of the Sangha. And he'd heard a talk, or somebody talking about Bhante, saying that in the Vajra Kula, everybody is naked. And Sangha Sen came to me, and he was very, very direct. He was from Nagpur, central India, Yavatmal. Very, very direct. He said, Pabhavajra, what's this? What's this naked? What's this naked truth? This naked communication? So I said, well, Sankha Sen, it means, you know, we're all open and honest and all that. Next time I saw him, he gave me a handbill. He said, look, look at the title of my next retreat, How to Be Naked. And he was so proud of this, and he was distributing it all over the place. And of course, nakedness in India is, it's not something you do. It's really, really challenging. But he really wanted to, you know, get through to people. He really wanted to communicate the nature of Sangha and spiritual practice. So, yes, there's the Vajrakula, where everybody is naked. But there's another word, which I'm very fond of, which is the Gana. The Gana. Very hard to translate Gana. A body of people, an entourage, a group of followers. Sangha actually used the word Gana when he gave us our name in India. We couldn't be called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order in India, of course. So he named us the Trilokya Bauda Mahasangha Sahayak Gana, which means the body of helpers of the great Buddhist spiritual community of the Triple World, which I think is a really good name for our work. I'm really sorry. Interestingly enough, at our first council meeting, he mentioned that there's a bodhisattva called a tantric bodhisattva called Trilokya Vijaya, the conqueror of the Triple World, which is a form of Atrapani, who's trampling on Ganesh and Lakshmi. And the Indian order members thought this was really terrific. I mean, we daren't mention these things now, do you? But, you know, they thought this was fantastic that there's a bodhisattva trampling on the Hindu gods, because for them, of course, the Hindu gods and goddesses are images of oppression, images of, you know, of caste and so on. But Gana, yes, so the Gana, body, entourage, group even. But it seems to be suggesting a very close, tight-knit, intimate spiritual community. That's what the Gana is. Very, very close. And the great practice of the Gana as a collective is what's called the Gana Chakra. The circle of the Gana, the circle of the Gana. And the circle of the Gana is a great feasting. It's puja and feast offerings focusing on the commonly held deities, or maybe one deity of the, you know, the tradition that the line of tantric practice that the Gana are following. And typically these pujas would involve not just puja and worship, but singing tantric songs, not in highly polished Sanskrit, but in the vernaculars, the old Oriya or Upper Brunksa, or these old Bengali, these languages that we've lost now, which are related to some of the modern Indian languages. They'd probably be dancing, yes, feasting, and other things which, you know, which are so esoteric I can't even mention. But there's this great sense of celebration. That's the impression you get from these gatherings of the community, this tremendous sense of celebration. After all, in the tantra, for the tantric practitioners, they really do believe that in their context that their guru is the Buddha. This is very, very important in the tantric tradition. The guru is fully enlightened. Sangharakshita's softened it right down, thankfully. The teacher is just a bit more developed. No, for these people, the guru is the Buddha. He's given this teaching, he's given this path, which leads to siddhi, the great siddhi, the supreme siddhi, in one lifetime, if you really practice it. And there are these brothers and sisters from all walks of life coming together to practice in this way. It's a tremendous sense of celebration, gratitude, intensity. Again, I think we can learn from these people, from these communities. Actually, that's what any Buddhist spiritual community should be like worth its salt. Okay, you won't see your teacher as the Buddha. That's very, very difficult. Okay, maybe you won't regard the practices you do as enlightenment in one lifetime. And, you know, you're not always so sure about your friends in the Dharma. Fact is, you've got this fantastic thing called the Dharma. You have this path through life which liberates you. I mean, all right, if that's too much, you have a human body. You have this very, very precious human existence. You've done something to attain this very, very precious human existence. You have this path, you have this teaching, you have these friendships. Why not celebrate? Why not celebrate every day? Why not give thanks? Why not praise for what you've been given? You could be in terrible circumstances and situations. This is one of the things I really like about reading sort of tantric texts. There's this tremendous emphasis on celebration. Celebration of the life of the Dharma. And you have to remember, it wouldn't have been easy for these tantric practitioners, because some of these tantric gurus are pretty heavy. Pretty heavy. I mean, it's all very well, you know, we like looking at the wonderful reproductions of tankas and the colourful dharkanis and put them on our shrines, on our wall. But, I mean, the worlds from which these images come, actually, we wouldn't have probably liked some of these teachers. We really wouldn't. You know, honestly, I mean, you think of poor Lama, well, think of Marpa. I mean, before Marpa was a teacher, imagine having Marpa as a teacher anyway, Milarepa's teacher. One of Marpa's teachers, great teacher, had to go and find this teaching. He lived on an island amidst a lake of poison. You know, so Marpa was told, you go to this place, there's a lake of poison. I presume, you know, if you slip, I don't know, maybe if it touches you, you're going to die of it. But it's a lake of poison on an island, completely inhabited by savage dogs. It's a Kakurapa, the dog ascetic. Not only that, I mean, check this out if you've got doubts about, you know, your order members in the centre and, you know, their habits. Kakurapa's consort, his dharkani, was a bitch. You know, a bitch. That was his sexual partner, as Ronald Davidson says, a curious choice. Now imagine that. You're suddenly told you've got to go and get this teaching from this nut who lives among dogs on an island in the midst of poison, who has some very, very questionable habits. But he's going to give the transmission, the really important transmission of the Dharma. You think we have problems in our Sangha? One of the things I think, one of the things, you know, you're all laughing, which I'm glad you're not taking it too seriously and you're not, you know, going, I don't know, call safeguarding or something. I'm not advocating, you know, Kukuripa's practice. I'm sure it's much more, it's symbolic rather than real. Got that in, that's all on tape. One of the things as well, as I say, I'm glad you're laughing, because there's a lot of humour as well in these stories of tantric Buddhists and the tantric communities. Again, Ronald Davidson has pointed out, he thinks there's a lot of burlesque in the and almost vaudeville within these tantric stories. I mean, you know, and some of them they're definitely going against the sort of canons of archetypal, you know, beauty and decorum that would go with Indian religious literature, like Virupa. Virupa means Mr. Ugly. Virupa means misshapen. And he's depicted as really fat. You know, and you know, there's all sorts of scatological humour in the stories of Virupa and his various tantric colleagues, particularly when they're, you know, trying to sort out the Shaiva human sacrifices. I won't go into all that because, you know, it's you know, it might be going too far. But there's a lot of emphasis on humour in this material, and I think that's very important. Play, leela, very, very important. And that's another thing I think that we need to bear in mind about, that needs to be a lot more leela, I think, in spiritual communities. Sometimes we get terribly heavy weather of our Buddhist life, terribly heavy weather, you know, this problem and working with this. You know, we can be so up ourselves. I mean, sort of ridiculous, really. And it's all because we take ourselves far too seriously. Far too seriously. In the general scheme of things, none of us are that important. Absolutely crucial for the development of the Dharma, but personally, not that important. And it's very important, I think, to have a sense of playfulness in relation to all this, being able to laugh at ourselves, laugh at our sillinesses. And you get that a lot in tantric literature. You get stories of failure, you know, siddhas becoming arrogant and conceited and having to be knocked down a peg or two. I love the story of Kunha, the black one. And he decided, he thought he'd really got somewhere with meditation. So he decided that he was going to walk across the ocean to Sri Lanka to convert Sri Lanka, Ceylon, to Buddhism. And as he walked across the waves, he just drowned, basically. Had to go back to his teacher. And his teacher says, go to the north, you'll go to the weaver's quarter, and you'll find your teacher. Goes to the weaver's quarter of this particular city. I don't know if it was Benares, and he's looking. And of course, weaver, again, low caste. That's weaver, you know, they shouldn't be practicing any kind of Buddhism. You won't find any teacher there. And he's looking at all these weavers. And he notices there's one who's not using his hands. So that, you know, the weaving is going on, and he's just sitting there watching. Ah, he must be the teacher. So he asks for a teaching. Give me a teaching. So the teacher says, okay, follow me. Out of the city. The teacher decides he needs to have a dump. So he squats, has a poo, and then says, eat it. And Kunha says, I'm not going to do that. What would people think? Not, I'm going to get ill. It's like, what would people think? And he said, well, I can't give you the teaching unless you eat it. You know, you can't, you know, I can't, you know, you've got to show that you're really serious. Yeah, I'm not. And then suddenly, these gods and goddesses start appearing, and the poo turns into this sort of golden nectar, which they consume. Poor Kunha, you know, missed out. We always miss out. We don't trust the teacher. Perhaps that's a good thing. I'm not sure. Anyway, where am I going with this? Anyway, yes, the Gunna. It has been pointed out this word Gunna is also used for a really motley crew in the which is in the entourage of Shiva, you know, the Hindu tantric god. All sorts of strange kind of characters, kind of human and semi-human, all a little bit odd, bit weird, bit strange, having a lot of fun, getting into trouble. I rather like that as an image for a spiritual community. I'd much rather think of ourselves like that rather than, you know, we're very sort of straight, very, you know, conformist. That, you know, yes, we are a bit odd, let's face it. You know, a bit odd and a bit strange and celebrating this life of ours. And the other thing that I want to mention, I really need to start sort of winding up, I think, because time's getting on. Another important element in these tantric communities, where they seem to arise from, one of the points that's been made is that they seem to operate in these sort of liminal spaces within Indian life. So I've mentioned cremation grounds, I've mentioned mountain peaks, I've mentioned communities which are regarded as outcast traditionally. Some people have pointed out, actually, in the development of Indian religion, that's where all the creative energy has been. This is Wendy Doniger's book on the Hindus, which has got banned in India. Her book is saying that the creative elements have come out of the liminal, not of in the mainstream, but have been sort of incorporated into the Hindu mainstream. And one area, of course, is the tribals. Some people believe that they notice that so much tribal imagery. So tribals, again, are regarded as sort of not part of the mainstream. And tribal imagery is really wonderful. You have this word sahaja in Indian tantric Buddhism, which is hard to translate. Co-emergent, that's much too wordy. Spontaneous is better. Natural, non-artificial. This sort of sense of the spontaneous, natural reality that's always there. You also get the word nija, again, which means sort of natural, non-artificial. So, of course, tribal imagery, you know, comes with that. And I'm going to read to you, before I start concluding, one of my favourite tantric songs. So this will, well, translation of a tantric song from the old Bengali. So this will give you a taste, you know, for you know, some of this literature. It's, well, I won't try to explain it, but try to get a feeling that this is trying to describe, trying to get at the great bliss, natural experience of a tantric practitioner. Higher and higher in the mountain, the Shabara girl lives. This Shabara nymph flaunts a peacock feather around her neck, a garland of red gunja berries. She scolds her lover. "You crazy Shabara, you drunken Shabara, don't raise a ruckus or cause a commotion. Don't you know I am your own wife, Sahaja Sundari, lady naturally beautiful?" Branches from the canopy of the diverse, excellent trees stroke the sky. Bearing earrings and a vajra, the Shabara girl rambles around the forest. The Shabara lays down his bower of the entire triple world, a bed thatched through with great ecstasy. For this Shabara is the real lover, with lady selflessness as his consort. Love lights up the night. Afterwards, he chews the essential betel and camphor with great ecstasy, thus receiving empty selflessness in his throat. Great ecstasy lights up the night. Hey, Shabara, obeying the guru's instruction, pierce your mind with your arrow, drawing one arrow. Pierce, pierce, highest nirvana. That crazy Shabara, because of wrath, he's wandered into the ravine between high mountain peaks. How's this Shabara ever going to get out? So, that's a, I think, a wonderful song describing spiritual experience. We have to kind of imagine what that experience is. But you notice the emphasis on bliss. You notice the emphasis on union with Lady Naturally Beautiful, which is empty selflessness. Is it with a real person, or is it something happening in the enlightened imagination? Very, very hard to know. But yes, there's this wonderful sense of freedom, this wonderful sense of living a life without any constraints, the life of genuine selflessness, which is a life of bliss, a life of love, a life of genuine communication, I would say. So I think I ought to start concluding somehow with this talk. Well, the time has sort of gone on because I've... Should I? You'll go on a bit longer? Okay. All right, well, I've gone a bit longer. I feel as though I've been going on for a long time. I want to talk... Let's try and, I hope, make it a bit more... I hope it hasn't been impractical, but maybe we should take all that emphasis on energy and bliss and so on and try to sort of channel it into... something nearer to hand. I want to talk next about commitment to the tantric community, what that might be like, and I want to talk about precepts within the tantric community, and then I'll finish. Okay, can you be patient with me and let me do that? Because we've sort of wandered around being very impressionistic about you know, the Indian scene. Let's try and make it a bit more practical. Well, making a commitment to a tantric community involves an encounter with a guru, doesn't it? And these gurus are notoriously no-nonsense. Sangharakshita, again in that Vajra lecture, talks about the Vajra guru as the no-nonsense guru, the no-nonsense teacher, because he's no-nonsense, because he doesn't care, or she doesn't care, what they do to you to wake you up to reality. They're not interested in your feelings. They're not interested in your opinions. They're not interested in your spiritual experiences. All they're interested in is waking you up to your reality. And I think I might have had a little glimpse of this with my own teacher. Little one, maybe. And it involves my Kalyana Mitra, the Santra. I'm going to give you a little insight into an esoteric community moment, a little insight into a gunner. So I came along to the movement when I was a callow youth of 17 or 18. To my great good fortune, I met first Buddhadasa, very, very dedicated order member indeed, living in Brighton, starting things in Brighton, who fortunately on my first night did a sevenfold puja. Thank goodness, no graded system of practice for me. By the end of the puja, I knew I'd devote my life to the Dharma. And I got stuck in. Another great good fortune, a bit later on, I met Visantra. And I'm sure all of you know this, how wonderfully kind and encouraging Visantra is. And he was extremely kind and encouraging to me. Took me seriously, which was probably quite hard for him at the time, me being so young and foolish. And he even took seriously my interest in mind-rotting tantric literature, as my dear friend Arloka used to call it. It was just always very encouraging. So naturally, I asked Buddhadasa and Visantra to be my Kalyana Mitras. And in those days, when you became a Mitra, when you made that initial commitment, you had to have two order members to be your Kalyana Mitras. So fortunately, I had two absolutely exemplary order members who could be my Kalyana Mitras. And they agreed, thankfully. So off we went, the Brighton Sangha, and it was a lovely little Sangha, actually, the Brighton Sangha. We went off to Thetford Forest, to a place called Broomhouse Farm, where Bhante was going to do lots and lots of Kalyana Mitra ceremonies. And in these ceremonies, you're just there with the celebrant and your two Kalyana Mitras. So you're in the middle. Either side is your Kalyana Mitras, and there's the person doing the ceremony. In this case, Bhante. So Bhante was wearing his yellow robes, long hair, you know, sort of quite disreputable looking, great, fantastic. You know, he's wearing the yellow robes of a monk, but he's got long, greasy hair and beads. I like that kind of iconographic clash, that ecclesiastical collision. Brilliant. So he's sitting there. Because I'm the youngest, I go in last. And in the ceremony, in the Kalyana Mitra ceremony, you make the offerings, the three offerings to the shrine, and then the person doing the ceremony gives a little discourse on the significance of the situation. Now, I don't know whether Bhante was tired, but he looked to me fed up. He looked sort of annoyed. I don't know if it looked severe. And he looked right at me, Visantra, Buddhadasa either side, in this little dark room. He said, becoming a Mitra is like joining a dance. It's like joining a dance. You've been on the outside of the dance, looking in. You've tried out a few steps, but this is you joining the dance. He said, everything's been thought, everything's been felt, everything's been said. This is you making an action. This is you doing something. This is you joining the dance in doing the ceremony. He went on and on about action. The need for action. The need for commitment. You know, yeah, even everything's been felt, you know, dismissed. Action. And I thought, oh, I'm a bad person. Anyway, I managed to get through the ceremony. I went outside. Visantra being very, very kindly, came up to me and said, he didn't talk like that to anybody else. And I thought, he hates me. But I haven't forgotten. I haven't forgotten that particular teaching, you know, the necessity of really acting, living it, doing it. And you know, thank goodness Vasantra was there to give me a hug and kind of reassure afterwards. But the necessity of really doing it. It's not about what we say. It's not about having given a great big long talk. It's not even about what we feel. It's about our action, our commitment. And in these communities, that's the really, really crucial thing. You make the commitment to the life. You really live the life. And there's sort of severe downfalls from tantric practice. You know, if you get angry with your teacher, that's a severe downfall. If you dismiss your teacher, that's a serious problem. If you dismiss the message of the Tathagata, of the Buddha, that's a serious problem. If you get angry with the other members of the feast, of the Gunna, of your community, that's a serious problem. You're seriously undermining your practice. If you disparage this precious human experience, human body, which has the potential for full Buddhahood, which has the Buddha potential, that's a serious problem. That's a serious issue which needs serious purification. So you get the development of sort of precepts, if you like, to do with these tantric communities, so that you really are taking it seriously. You really are keeping up your commitment to the practice. Sangharakshita himself, in the early days of the movement, actually came up with a set, I presume they're his, of tantric precepts, called the tantric version of the five precepts. He said later, because in the early days people weren't particularly interested in the precepts, he thought he needed to do something that would make it a bit more exciting, and people were into the tantra, quote. So, but this is a really good set. It's a wonderful teaching. I do study on it sometimes. And I'm going to end my talk with this. Looking at this as the kind of communication that goes on within our community. It's all to do with energy. It's all about energy. Tantric Buddhism has a lot of concerns about energy. Freeing up energy, purifying energy. I think Sangharakshita on one occasion said the only thing really stopping us from breaking through into Buddhahood is our lack of energy. We need to free it up. We need to purify it, refine it, concentrate it. And of course, again, this sort of tantric realism, they want to know where things are. So the bodhicitta, you know, we hear about this word bodhicitta, the urge of wisdom and compassion to the full realization of wisdom and compassion for all beings. Where is that in experience? Well, they identify it with semen. That's a bit weird, doesn't it? And, you know, don't do this at home, folks. But I think I see that metaphorically. I don't want to get into the sort of yogic technicalities of it, because I don't know anything about it. But, you know, it's this idea of potency. The potency of bodhicitta, the tremendous creative energy of bodhicitta, whether or not you're male or female, the tremendous energy. So we need that energy along the path. You could even call it life itself. I don't know if you've ever studied Sangharakshita's Ten Pillars of Buddhism. When he talks about the first precept, it's quite extraordinary what he talks about. Life being the greatest good. And to negate another is to negate yourself. You know, to negate another with violence of any kind is to negate life itself, is to negate you. Life is extraordinarily precious. And I wonder if he's getting at the sort of energy of life, life wanting to fulfill itself in full enlightenment through the bodhicitta. So the tantric version of the five precepts are, first of all, do not obstruct the energy of any other person. Do not obstruct the energy of any other person. Within the tantric community, within the spiritual community, get out of people's way. get out of the way of their flowing energy towards enlightenment, their energy of growth. When I say get out of the way, I don't mean ignore them. I mean really notice that energy as it starts to surge, as it starts to transform them, and observe it, witness it, encourage it, as you know, that, like I said earlier, being taken seriously, being encouraged by somebody like Visantra when I was a kid, I mean, just meant so much. It meant I could put my energy into the Dharma, being taken completely seriously by Sangharakshita, more seriously than I'd ever taken myself, releases tremendous energy. And that's what a real spiritual friend does. They take your energizing for enlightenment, your energizing for the Dharma, completely seriously. And they get out of your way and let you do it. Do not drain the energy of others. Give freely of your own energy. Don't drain the energy of others. You know that thing sometimes, you know, when somebody's, you know, around you, they're kind of nagging you or, I don't know, telling you all about their problems again and again and again and again, and you suggest something, they say, no, that won't work. And you suggest something else, no, that won't work. Well, there comes a point where you've got to say, stop, that's enough. You know, because you're draining energy. You're draining your own energy, you're draining my energy. Another Sangharakshita story, wandering around the hills of Tuscany on an ordination course, and I had a problem. I talked about it with him. He made a very practical suggestion. I kept talking about it. And suddenly this voice beside me said, can I say something now? I was draining his energy. And he was not going to have that. He was going to break through. Can I say something now? Give freely of your own energy. This is really important, giving freely of your own energy, which freely, you know, it's that word. It's not straining, it's not sort of pushing yourself, it's not burnout. It's accessing that energy of bodhicitta, let's call it that, that energy of life, of growth, of the Dharma, of transformation, and giving it freely, not holding it back. There are things to do. People need help. Give freely of your energy. I remember, you know, Buddhadasa telling me in the early days of the movement, going along and Bhante giving these talks, Sangharakshita giving these talks, going on about the movement this, the movement that, as if it's some big thing. But it was a big thing in his mind, this tremendous sort of vision. And one day Buddhadasa looked around the room at a rather sort of shabby group of people, thought, blimey, this is it. He needs help. So he just went and offered his help. Give freely of your own energy. Do not misuse energy. Of course, this is the third, so it's associated with sexual misconduct, although I think it's wider than that. So easy to misuse energy, especially nowadays. Facebook, Twitter, the internet, YouTube, this, that, the other. You know, so we're so, you know, we've become a kind of world of busybodies, you know, poking our beaks in other people's affairs, which is just a misuse of energy. It's just completely draining us of all the energy we need for the path. Don't misuse energy. Don't misuse. Use it well. It's precious stuff. Really choose what you give your energy to. You know, make sure it's going to be enhancing your life and other people's lives. Don't misuse energy. Use for any given purpose the energy appropriate to that purpose, not one which is inappropriate. So the energy's got to be true to the situation, true to the context. So this brings, I think, in skillful means, you know, tact, skill. You know, sometimes, you know, you have got to be very, very tender with others within the Sangha. Very, very tender, very empathic. Sometimes you've got to draw lines. Sometimes you've got to be very, very clear. I've been reflecting quite a lot of my interactions with Sangharakshita over the years. I tend to associate so many of these things with him. I mean, there have been times, you know, most of the time his communication with me was really sort of gentle. Although, you know, when I argued with him, he would, because I used to argue with him very foolishly, he would sort of come back, but after a while he'd just withdraw. It was quite obvious I hadn't convinced him. But, you know, he wasn't going to come down to my level. But most of the time it was gentle. It was, you know, really trying to understand how I saw things. The only time he was fierce with me, and he was really fierce with me on one occasion, when I was being unkind about other people, about another person, willfully uncaring about somebody. And he decided enough was enough, and on came the burners. It was appropriate. It broke through my stupidity in that moment. But he wasn't like that all the time. So the energy has to be appropriate to the situation. You can see it too in meditation. Sometimes there is a time for, you know, energy in meditation, for really, how can I say, really applying effort and energy to what's going on, but not all the time. You have to sort of also have to sit back and allow things to unfold, but don't do that all the time either. You have to be really tuned up to what's going on for you and what's going on around you. And finally, do not allow energy to become turbid. Keep it clear and bright. Don't let it all get all sort of dull and heavy. And of course, that means paying attention to what you give your energy to. You know, don't be surprised, you know, if your energy is really sort of dull. If you've spent the evening, you know, distracting yourself on the internet or whatever you get up to, I don't know. The next day you're going to be really, you know, really dull, really, really slothful. Make sure the energy is clear and bright, which means keeping up all of the practices. It means that perhaps especially, as well as all the things that inspire us in the Dharma, meditation, study and puja and so on, but perhaps especially meeting spiritual friends, meeting Kalyana Mitras, meeting others in our community, whether it's a tantric community, whatever kind of community it is, meeting in friendship, meeting in love, meeting in celebration of what we're doing. We have this amazing thing called the Dharma, absolutely amazing thing called the Dharma, which brings so much benefit to the world. You know, I've had the great good fortune of, as I said, of living in India, you know, going to different countries, and there's no doubt in my mind that the Dharma liberates. It liberates energy. No doubt at all. So let's keep the energy clear and bright. So there you are. That's my having a go at imagining the tantric gana, the tantric community. Thank you.